It's The Wonky Show. Today we're talking about pushback to ministers on their plans to pause free speech legislation, what's going on with international student applications, and we ask how universities can play a role in social mobility in a new political climate. It's all coming up.
I've always said that education is the next best thing to a record deal, and I think that the Social Mobility Commission report by and large bears that out.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and here to decode the week in higher education, as usual, three fantastic guests. In Norwich, it's Chris Husbands, former Vice Chancellor and Director of Higher Futures. Chris, your high for the week, please.
Oh, my high for the week, I'm in Norwich with my grandchildren.
In Bristol, it's Steph Harris, Director of Strategy, Insight and Member Engagement at Universities UK. Steph, your high for the week, please.
My highlight of the week is that I got invited to the University Alliance Awards on Tuesday at the University of West London and had a great time seeing some fantastic staff and students. So thanks to the University Alliance for inviting me, although other mission groups are available.
Lovely. And in North London this week, it's Debbie McVitie, editor of Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, yesterday we launched the working programme for the Festival of Higher Education taking place on the 12th and 13th of November in partnership with the University of London at Senate House, at the historic Senate House. So this is my opportunity to take a plug to say get on the website, look at what is coming up, all the very, very interesting and cool conversations we'll be having, and secure your ticket now because they're selling out fast.
Yes, only a few left. When they're gone, they're gone. So please do check that out. Brilliant. Right, we start the week with free speech. Debbie, talk us through it.
Right, so as we are all extremely aware, the last government passed the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act. Now, that was due to come into effect from August of this year, but back in July, the new Secretary of State for Education, Bridget Phillipson, announced that the implementation of the Act would be put on hold while the new government had a chance to review what the implications would be. And Phillipson was quite, I think there were two kind of driving reasons, rationales behind that. One was that universities were saying this is going to be very, very hard to implement, potentially very, very expensive, and we're facing an awful lot of, you know, broader financial challenge. And in this context, this is not necessarily a particularly helpful piece of legislation. And you know, there's lots that remains unresolved. And also, Bridget Phillipson had been listening to groups, particularly Jewish advocacy groups, Jewish students groups, that had been saying this creates conditions for anti-Semitism to flourish on campus. And this is obviously something that has been historically challenging, both in universities and for the Labour Party more generally. So the intention, I believe, is to scrutinise the plans for the implementation of the Act, take views and understand kind of what they, you know, and just put the whole thing on pause while the government can kind of get to grips and make a plan for the next steps in that space. It's not an intention to say, you know, we dislike freedom of speech, but inevitably that has created quite a lot of political challenge. So at Education Questions this week, Secretary of State faced questions about her commitment to academic freedom and freedom of speech, whether this was anything to do with universities' relationships with China and other authoritarian regimes. And in the Times this morning, we read that a number of Nobel laureates have written to the Secretary of State saying that this is a mistake and the Act should be taken forward. So it was a bold choice, and it remains to be seen what the kind of next steps will be in terms of whether a version of the Act is implemented, whether it gets scrapped altogether, or something else entirely.
Yeah, and we have a clip, I think, of Bridget Phillipson from that discussion.
We looked very carefully and very closely at the way in which the legislation was going to operate. I want to make sure that we've got good, strong, workable legislation. I was concerned about what I'd heard from Jewish groups and other minority communities about the unintended consequences that might follow from the legislation. That's why I paused commencement with a view to getting this right, making sure we protect academic freedom, but also avoiding the situation where hate speech is allowed to flourish on campus.
Right. Steph, I'll come to you first. In your view, was this, you know, good, strong, robust, or whatever Bridget said, good legislation?
No, I don't think it was good legislation. And, you know, that's kind of why we're kind of pleased to see Labour have paused it. And I think, you know, Debbie's already said this, but I think it's worth repeating, right, that we're really clear. Sally Mapstone, our president, the Universities UK president in our conference last week, was really clear that universities are absolutely committed to free speech and academic freedom. but this legislation and the way in which it was going to be implemented wasn't clear enough. It wasn't helpful and was likely to make it more difficult for universities to navigate what are actually extremely complex responsibilities when thinking about how you do that at the same time as keeping your students safe and free from harassment. So, you know, we'll see where Labour comes back with, but you're right that the message has to be absolutely clear that this isn't because we don't, you know, want freedom of speech. We don't like freedom of speech. It's not about that. It's about finding a way of legislating and regulating it that is helpful and doesn't have unintended consequences.
Yeah, I think, I mean, listeners of the Wonky Show will have heard discussions about this, these proposals in exhaustive detail, and obviously the coverage on the site. And it's fair to say we've been fairly critical for similar reasons. I think I'm interested this morning, Chris, this, you know, this kind of group of Nobel laureates joined together to say, you know, to ask the Secretary of State to think again. I don't want to sound churlish, but my theory is that they're basically a bit confused because they think this is all about academic freedom, and they've been told by campaigners that stopping the free speech bill in its tracks will harm academic freedom in some way. And I suspect, or I can't be sure, that that's being sort of deliberately, you know, the water has been muddied deliberately for the people, by the people who want to keep this legislation going.
I think there's some truth in that, and I think that the rights in this overall space tend to be clear if complex. The responsibilities and the range of perspectives are generally less clear and even more complex. And freedom of speech is incredibly important. Academic freedom is incredibly important. But they're not quite the same thing. And the measures in place that universities need to have are overlapping, but they're slightly different. And generally, when you put complex things together, they don't become simpler if you try to think of them as a single entity. So I'm with Steph, and I think I'm with the general wonky view that pausing the legislation was the right thing to do. It was poorly drafted legislation. I thought that some of the contributions from Jewish advocacy groups pointing out some of the flaws, potential flaws and unintended consequences in the legislation were extremely helpful. I think there's a really difficult navigation to be done. We all know, those of us who've had senior posts in universities, that navigating through rights, responsibilities, perspectives is becoming yet more complex. So you need a legal framework, but the relationship between the legal framework and management freedom to respond to individual cases is going to prove to be incredibly complicated, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Debbie, the other issue here is about the regulatory burden, isn't it? Because the signal has been sent that they want to, you know, cut back on all that to help save the sector money when there's obviously, you know, a funding crisis, also discussed on previous episodes of the Wonky Show. You know, how do we strike that balance though? Because, you know, clearly we also need regulation, but the regulation has to work, doesn't it? It can't be overly burdensome or expensive.
Well, I mean, I think that there's a fascinating interaction with the other big news of the summer, which was Sir David Behan's independent report into the Office for Students, and the kind of his subsequent appointment as interim chair of the regulator, because it signals a shift in direction and a refocusing of regulatory activity. And of course, you know, over at OFS, there has been appointed a Director for Free Speech and Academic Freedom, who's Arif Ahmed, who now sort of finds himself twiddling his thumbs a little bit. And I think there's probably, if you know, charting a forward course, because for me, and Jim's written about this in kind of very sophisticated ways in the site on a number of occasions, free speech, it's completely legitimate, I think, for a regulator to want to be confident that a university has a sort of robust set of policies and kind of understanding and sort of leadership attention to those questions, because of course if they are not safeguarded, they erode. But because the legislation was framed in such a way as to kind of imply that there's a sort of systematic efforts to undermine freedom of speech in universities, which we know is not the case, actually, this is about people making kind of complex decisions in the context, in complex contexts in which there are an awful lot of competing views. So I think that there is probably space to say, what if we, whatever the kind of future of the kind of directorial role, one of the recommendations of the BN review was that perhaps there shouldn't be quite so many people who are at a sort of equivalent, appointed sort of independently and as directors of the Office of Students, because it makes it very hard for the chief executive to actually run their team. They've got all these extra people who are appointed in a different way. But that's probably a sidebar issue. I think in terms of freedom of speech, that there is a job to think through, it's very much a co-regulation question. How can the sector demonstrate and put into practice and be sophisticated and demonstrate that it's able to be sophisticated in making these judgments in these highly complex situations, whether that's anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, issues around kind of trans rights of transgender people and so on. How can it demonstrate productively that it is able to make sophisticated judgments and balance those competing interests? And how can the regulator be assured of that in a way that then doesn't create this climate of fear in which universities are constantly at risk of being kind of hauled up in front of the regulator and told that they're getting it wrong. And there's a really, I think, positive opportunity to genuinely advance the cause of academic freedom and freedom of speech, along with the cause of thinking about how do we keep people who are vulnerable in a position where they're not kind of, where they're not subjected to hate speech on a kind of daily basis. And I'm not sure that, because the answer to that is always it's going to be hard and it's going to be contextual. So it depends entirely on the sophistication and capabilities of the people making those judgments in universities, not on the not on a regulatory architecture and the stick that is being used to kind of wait for them to put a foot wrong in making those judgments.
So I just want to come in on a couple of things that Debbie has said. I think that's pretty well correct. I think the question for the future direction of the OFS is, and there is a question about the role, but let's assume the role persists. How does the role work with institutions to enable them to make better judgments in a complex environment? So we will all get things wrong in this space. The question about getting things wrong is how quickly can you learn from them and how can you communicate that learning across the sector? And I could see a role in which the OFS plays a brokering role in driving improvement above a regulatory floor rather than simply policing the territory in which everybody feels they're always likely to get things wrong. Just from a legislative point of view, so we do have the legislation on the statute book and it's not going away. And clearly, it's not a defensible position for government to have an act which is never implemented. That just looks tricky. So I think there's some really challenging questions for government as well as for the sector in how the next few months are navigated.
My reflections over the last year and the work that we've done at Universities UK is that some of the most powerful work that we've done in this space has been facilitating that conversation between institutions to learn from one another about what works, what doesn't work, and how you respond to really complex situations. And moving to that kind of co-regulatory approach rather than where I think we were or would have ended up with the act that was being implemented in the way in which it was being implemented, which much more was, frankly, something that probably would have made lawyers an awful lot of money, but would have been incredibly difficult to navigate and would have resulted in universities having to navigate those judgments with less certainty about what the outcome was likely to be rather than more certainty. And clearly that's not a helpful space to be.
I mean, I think for me, it's this issuing from the Ministry of Unpopular Opinions before the culture wars kicked off, before the Freedom of Speech Act was a twinkle in Gavin Williamson's eye. I have always thought that there was space for universities to take a more proactive approach to thinking about free speech, particularly kind of in the age of social media, and as geopolitics get more complicated, as different groups of students, as the student body diversifies and you have sort of different interests in play, a decade ago the situation we had was one in which universities were sort of obliged to secure freedom of speech and sort of demonstrate that they weren't you know, that they weren't essentially kind of constraining it. I think that there is an argument, and I think you know, universities are probably kind of quite open to this, in which there is an expectation that universities say, not only are we securing it, we're also advancing it. We're also kind of actively creating space for things to be discussed and learning collectively about how to you know, to disagree well, to argue. Now, I realize that that is not. That is a sort of, you know, that sort of utopian picture of everyone kind of politely is not going to be the case. There's going to be hard battles fought. But given that those battles are being fought, there needs to be that learning, and there needs to be that kind of shared understanding about how that is done in the contemporary world that we live in.
When I reflect on the situations in both the institutions I led that threatened to overwhelm the day-to-day business, social media is a major contributor, and I think that there is a real challenge. I mean, universities, generally speaking, are not geared around the world of social media. Universities like to make slow, deliberative decisions. They like to reflect on evidence. They like to consult. Change tends to be slow in universities, and there are all sorts of benefits from that, but it sits very ill in the world of social media. And I can think of a couple of instances where between me getting on my bike and leaving one campus and arriving on my bike at the second campus, something had just blown up out of all proportion. That's unfair of me. Something had blown up on social media. And instantly, you're on the back foot and you're making decisions that tend to be suboptimal, because you're not quite clear where everything is going. And I think that's a really, really difficult challenge for the sector, and one where we've probably got to do some harder thinking about how universities manage themselves in relation to social media.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
My name is Mandy Crawford-Lee, and I'm the Chief Executive of the University Vocational Awards Council, more commonly known as UVAC. UVAC's role is to represent the views of our 80 or more university members and corporate supporters on aspects of high-level skills and apprenticeship policy in England. Before the election, UVAC surveyed its members and what policy commitments and funding support the new government should provide to ensure technical and professional skills and higher degree apprenticeships meet employer needs. Our members are quite clear that with a Labour win, the government should continue the progress made in supporting higher degree apprenticeship growth. UVAC is not of the view that the levy is a failed experiment, but instead help support the delivery of apprenticeships across all levels, all ages, and by all types of providers.
Now, we've got new application data for international students. Steph, walk us through it, please.
Yes. So today, the international student visa applications for the key month of August is out. And the figures are, as we expected, really, although I might say as expected and therefore bad. So in August 2024, there are 121,900 study visa applications. And that's 17% down on August of last year. And in the period between January in August of this year, 278,700 applications compared to 334,200 applications between January and August 2023, which is also a 17% change. This week, we also had confirmation that international students will need to demonstrate a higher level of funds from January. That amount had been frozen since 2020 and had been leading to fears that international students were coming to the UK with insufficient money to support themselves. It's been raised, but it's been raised to the equivalent of home student maintenance loans or also described as the maximum allowance for English domiciled students.
17% down. Catastrophe?
Well, I think as Steph indicated, it's people who've been paying attention, and I'm sure an awful lot of Pro Vice Chancellors International will have been paying extremely close attention, will know that this is very much in line with what we've been seeing this year. Post the new policy on postgraduate taught students bringing dependence, you know, in the context of currency crises in major recruiting countries such as Nigeria. So this is something that the sector has been preparing itself before and will have been kind of already grappling with. On the other hand, there is a large challenge here, because we have seen, this is us coming off the back of two kind of big boom years of international recruitment. And where the worry has been is that if universities have been operating on the assumption that that boom would continue, then that leaves just a big hole in budgets. So there will have been quite a lot of rethinking of how to manage those holes. And certainly, I think anyone who was expecting a kind of last minute boost will be disappointed by these numbers.
Yes. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think that there'll be a fair number of PVCs international who are saying, gosh, only 17%. That's a bit of a relief. But I think a lot of this is baked in. We need to understand a lot more about what's going on underneath these figures. How far is this about volatility in different markets? Does this look like a permanent depression? We expect international student recruitment to do an awful lot of work in our business plans, in our soft power thinking, in our thinking about diversity across campus. And there was a broad assumption that the long-term growth would continue, irrespective of the short-term boom that seemed to happen a couple of years ago, but that the long-term growth would continue. The UNESCO data seems to suggest that. It looks towards a virtual doubling of demand for global higher education between now and 2040. But I think there's going to be an awful lot of very hard stress testing of plans and recalibration of strategies get going on. I think that work had already started, and the figures today, no organization can look at a 20% fall in demand and think that things are hunky-dory. But I think quite a lot of this was already baked in.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I think the other thing that's important to say about today's figures is that they are visa applications, and visa applications are not international student enrollments on campus. So whilst they kind of give us an indicator of where things are heading, I guess you shouldn't assume that they will translate, that conversion will be the same year on year, because other things affect that conversion and who actually kind of turns up on campus to study.
There's better mood music from government though, isn't there, Debbie? I mean, that whole video from the Secretary of State saying, you know, international students are welcome, although policy isn't being wound backwards in terms of dependence and other things that the sector might be lobbying on. It is noticeable, isn't it, that the message has changed quite a bit.
Yeah, and I think it's part of a broader rapprochement on the part of the government towards universities. Bridget Phillipson said earlier this week, universities are engines of opportunity and growth, which I think will be music to a lot of vice chancellor's ears. And likewise, that international students are absolutely fundamental and welcome. And we should not be kind of trying to find ways to restrict their numbers. We should be welcoming them with open arms. She said that in July in a speech to ambassadors. I think that though, it is also while it's really welcome to hear the Secretary of State say, speak really positively and demonstrate essentially understanding of how important international students are to the sector and more broadly, there's a few things going on behind the scenes. One is about, and I think Steph could speak to this, but it's pretty clear that Universities UK feels quite strongly that the degree of subsidy that international student numbers are bringing is not a sustainable, like that is not the optimal way that the sector's funding should not depend on international recruitment, because it is too volatile and is creating all kinds of challenges in terms of kind of what is provided. So there's that. And the other thing, of course, is whether the government would be prepared to actively support policy agendas that enable the sector to increase recruitment and what the kind of implications would that be for politically. One of the things that Minister for Skills said last week in addressing a UK conference, kind of almost in passing really, but she said, you can take the girl out of the Home Office, but you can't take the Home Office out of the girl. And I think that it signals perhaps that while the government will be positive about the idea of international recruitment in principle, the sector may need to do a bit more work to convince the government that there are things that can be done to generate a sort of long-term managed sustainable recruitment strategy that delivers on that growth that sort of seems to be possible if the environment is right.
Develop a couple of points there, because I think you're absolutely right. And I think that what has changed, and I wouldn't underplay the importance of the change, is the mood music and the rhetoric around the sector. Clearly, the policies to deliver the change of mood music and rhetoric are going to take, well, are not there yet. And there is a gap between the very positive things that government are saying quite rightly about the sector and what that translates into in terms of the real world of sustainable funding and sustainable policy. I think there's an awful lot of work to be done there. If we sort of helicopter up and look at UK PLC for a moment, it seems pretty crazy that we should be assuming that the long-term sustainability of a critical national industry and a global research effort should be predicated on volatile international markets. That just feels a bad bit of policy design. Now, you're right, Home Office takes a particular view, DfE, DSIT take a rather different view, the sector takes yet another view. Reconciling those into good policy is going to take some very hard work.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the hares were set running, weren't they, Steph, when this big tender came out about English language testing, and there's been some confusion about what the government's intention actually is. Some speculation that this is about bringing it all in house. Is it just about studying? What's actually going on here?
Yeah, so as you say, HES was set running because of two things. Clearly, the MAC review in its response suggested that kind of English language testing and kind of standards and levels when recruiting international students should be looked at. In July, I think the Home Office indicated that it planned a review of English language and English language testing. And then we saw this tender come out last week. Our understanding is that tender, though, is not just for English language testing for study visas. It's a kind of wider UK visas and immigration review of how it does English language testing for all visas, not just study visas specifically, and therefore isn't related to the kind of MAC review and the response to that, although we are still expecting a response to that MAC review and for Labour to take forward what was out within it.
But still, is it a consultation on how this might be done differently in the future, including making one single supplier, has a decision been made to do that essentially and make one supplier for absolutely all of them, and that this is the tender to put interest in to deliver that?
Yeah, I mean, we're asking UKVI that exact question and trying to get more detail out of them, and are really clear that and asking kind of, I'm going to use the word vociferously, that there is consultation on any changes made before kind of any implementation is taken forward. So I'm not sure that we're 100% clear on that last point at the moment, but we're trying to get that clarity as quickly as possible.
And Debbie, there's been this other change this week, hasn't there, on requirements for international students. What's going on there?
Yep. So the change is that in order for international students to be able to come to the UK, they have to demonstrate that they have adequate funds to support themselves. That is now being pegged to the maximum maintenance loan that UK undergraduates are able to take out. Now, this is one of those moments that you would think would make perfect sense, because, of course, if the maximum maintenance loan is what UK undergraduates can have access to fund their living costs, and that sort of matches in terms of what we might expect international students to be able to demonstrate. The problem with that, but the problem on both sides with that, as Jim has pointed out on the site, is that the maximum maintenance loan comes nowhere near actually covering the cost of what it costs to study in the UK. So, and I think something that is worth trying to think about is the difference between a sort of compliance thing that says, this is what we expect you to be able to demonstrate, and whether that should be pegged to the real costs of study, or whether that is just a sort of, you've got something to kind of keep you going, and what is reasonable to ask, I guess. and what is communicated about the real costs of study, because and that applies to both UK and international. I think the costs of participation are increasing. The maintenance loan has increased by less than inflation over a number of years now, and it simply doesn't. One of the recommendations of the Augur review was that there'd be better communication about what additionally would be expected to be found from personal funds, even if you're able to, essentially what the cost of study is. And if you take the maintenance loan, that is only going to meet part of the cost. And this is what's exercising Jim, essentially, that if the information isn't there about what it costs, then international students are going to find themselves in very difficult circumstances when they get here, because they're going to, lower quality housing, working in the black economy and so on. And this is the worry, that there's not, that these things are sort of giving the wrong message about what it actually costs to study here.
Now, every week this season, we'll be having a think about how things were and how things came to be with City St George's University of London's academic registrar, Mike Ratcliffe. Here's the hidden history of higher education.
I think one of the things about university history is that we've always had it. We've always been interested in the previous history and what's been going on. So my favourite little bit is the fight between Oxford and Cambridge to be the oldest. So they set off and we, the historians, know that there's learning happening all over the place, and slowly it coalesces into universities. But we know that Cambridge gets a big shot in the arm when there's a big riot in Oxford, and sufficient students and lecturers go over to Cambridge and get it going. And it's 1209 and it's fine, and off they go. But that sets up a precedence that clearly if people left Oxford to go to Cambridge, then Oxford must be older than Cambridge. But all of the kind of precedence sits on who's the oldest university. So they get to the 17th century, and this isn't enough. So you get this battle between these mad antiquarians as to who can be the oldest university. And they start producing books. So, I mean, this would be great, be referable stuff. And they start making up quotes in order to guarantee that my university is older than your university. So Oxford kind of kicks off by saying that it was founded by King Alfred. So that puts it about 400 years older than it ought to be. But King Alfred founds it, and they find a quote that a guy sticks into a translation of Asser's Life of Alfred, saying that St. Grimble came over to found the University of Oxford. And he just puts it in this edition of the book. And it's completely bogus, but he just shoves it in. So that proves that Oxford is founded around 800. So that makes it, nice and old. But then, in a next edition, they decide that that's not enough. So they find an even older quote, and that says that Grimble didn't found it, he reformed it, and that it had been founded 400 years earlier than that by a bunch of Anglo-Saxon saints. And they list all those saints out, and that's all very nice. And so they got a list of these people. And so they're much older. So clearly they managed to push that back. And why is that? Well, Cambridge has meantime got to found that they've been founded by someone called Canterbury's. And he's been helped by King Arthur. So that pushes them earlier than King Alfred. So they've been founded by King Arthur, and King Arthur's gone and found Athenian philosophers to come over, and he's made his university, and so they're much older than Oxford. So clearly there's then a reaction. And so Oxford seems to trump the entire thing by coming up with this ruse, and it coalesces with the idea that England must be really old and ancient. It can't just be an accident of successive waves of people invading it. So they were founded by the Trojans, who had escaped the siege of Troy, and they'd sailed around the Mediterranean, and they had arrived, and they'd set up the University of Oxford. And to deal with the fact that there's a small issue of there not being any Greek temples in Oxford to prove that it's actually founded 2,000 years before Christ, they add this extra embellishment that it was burned down by the Romans. So they're so old that they were burned down by the Romans. So this backwards and forwards in order to get precedence produces these books. So each of the universities has a published book that lists their history up to the conquest, 1066. We know that the universities could not have been in existence until at least 100 years after. But these guys have produced these fabulous books saying we're so old that we've been going for so long. Because it mattered who goes first. And we're just used to saying Oxford and Cambridge. We're used to Oxbridge. And the precedence mattered because ecclesiastical preferments and stuff like that. So off they go. So really fun that they're, you know, right from the outset, they're very keen on how ancient they are. The colleges fight for this. So there's this kind of battle of who's the oldest college. So Oxford has three colleges that claim it. One has the oldest statutes, one has the oldest buildings, and one has the earliest foundation. And it's what makes the university, the college the oldest. Is it who gave them the money, who set up the buildings, or who had the first statutes? And I think there's a kind of tie now between Merton, Balliol, and UNIF to say, well, it doesn't really matter. We're definitely the oldest, the three of us. But again, in the listings, it was done by age, and therefore you wanted to be at the top of the list, and therefore, you know, that mattered. So this kind of thing about how old we are, which I would confess, I'm sitting in a university that is very proud to be 175 years old, even though it became a university in 1992. So that notion that we have to be old, we have to show our heritage, is very important to universities. There's just a thing about pecking order. Now, clearly, if we'd have been in a country where all of our universities had all been founded at the beginning of the 19th century, maybe we wouldn't have this stuff. But the Americans have it big time. Who's the oldest university really matters. How long they go back. Who was the first state university? Who was the first land-grant university? Who was the first university in this state? It all kind of matters and builds up over time. So this kind of competition to see who was founded before who. There's a whole very, very long discussion about who's the third university in England. And that's a battle between Durham and King's and UCL as to who was properly a university early enough. UCL was set up decently, and we'll talk about that in a bit, about really setting it up to be a proper, fully founded university in 1826. Durham becomes a university in the 1830s. And then, so this battle backwards and forwards about who's oldest. So third university, very dull, because it doesn't have any of the attraction of the two oldest ones.
Now, the Social Mobility Commission's had its annual report out. Chris, walk us through that, please.
So this is a really interesting report. The Social Mobility Commission was established by the Child Poverty Act of 2010, and that means that the Commission is one of those rare things that has survived Labour, Coalition, Conservative, and now into a Labour government. And it published its annual report yesterday. There's probably four important things in it for us, and then one really big thing that everybody should be looking at very carefully. So the finds there appears to be a closing of the socioeconomic gap in university enrollment over the last 8 years, with chapter and verse on that. Second, the report demonstrates just how different London is to the rest of the country on almost every indicator at every level of the education system. Thirdly, it pulls off some pretty clear evidence on the positive relationship between higher qualifications and higher earnings, at least up to first degree level. Finally, there are some really interesting composite place-based indices which have real lucidity and power in unlocking thinking about social mobility. Somebody I worked with once said that giving me data was like feeding ice cream to children. There was an inexhaustible appetite, and I think the data in those indices is just enormously interesting. Major limitation on the report is that as far as universities are concerned, it stops at university enrollment. It looks at the data on differences in enrollment at an entry to university, but it's not good at tracking progress through. And I think that's an agenda that is going to need to be opened up. But I thought the most important comment comes at the end. And it is a sort of two-sentence quotation, which I think is really important. It says, creating an innovative generation requires a shift in thinking about the pathway to a better life. This includes developing skills and knowledge from technical to academic as a way to providing the enterprising, inventive, and innovative qualities we now need. And I think once you take that, link it to the new government skills agenda, link it to Peter Kyle's announcement of the end of the war on universities, and there's a really important and significant agenda for the sector. But only if they rise, I think, to the challenge of being generous partners in place-based change that focuses not just on getting students in, but on supporting them to thrive and to progress afterwards. But it's a fantastic report, full of really interesting data, very, very well presented. And if the hidden agenda was for the Social Mobility Commission to say to government, we're important, I think they get game, set and match on that.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Thanks, Chris. So, Debbie, I guess the challenge is back to the sector, isn't it? I mean, how are universities going to respond to this for the next 5 years? Because clearly there is a big, wide open opportunity, but also an enormous set of challenges. And I think, as Chris points out, isn't there is significant balance to be struck between how universities are going to play ball with this, and how universities are going to regulate. Sorry, and how the government is going to regulate or announce policy and tinker with the system.
So, looking at this report, the thing that really struck me, and I think Chris has touched on this, is about the need for a joined up approach, which is a bit of the government's only been in place for about 3 months, and we're already, it's become a bit of a buzzword, hasn't it, joining things up. But we know this already, the sector has made good progress on access, and I think on creating opportunities to take up higher education opportunities for those from less disadvantaged backgrounds. Chris is absolutely right to signal, I think one of the challenges we're seeing now is not about access, although obviously there's more work to be done. But some of that is about kind of further down the pipeline. It's about being able to flourish and succeed once in higher education. It's probably a bit about the range of higher education opportunities that are available, because that remains moderately narrow. And it's about creating opportunities where no opportunity exists because there's cold spots. So there's a basket of work to be done in that basket of access stuff. Absolutely, but to me, there, one of the kind of weaknesses of the system that we have is that the focus has been kind of universities doing access. And I don't think universities should stop being held to account on who they're admitting and how they're helping them succeed or any of that. But it is also very, very clear that unless you've got transport links, unless you've got poverty strategies, unless you've got a curriculum in schools that supports students to kind of make choices about where they're going, Then a lot of this stuff is not going to work. And and thinking in that place based way about how you help places to flourish, I think is genuinely exciting opportunity to think about access and opportunity in the round, rather than a sort of thing that universities need to do better at just in and of itself.
I agree with that. And I think this report and also other conversations that have been happening over the last few months and years have really shone that light on the regional aspects of access and participation and then success in higher education, and the fact that there are kind of big disparities there. I'm probably going to mangle the stat, but I think you will have heard UCAS speaking quite a lot recently about the fact that I think it's 70% of people students in Wimbledon go on to participate in higher education, and it's only 18% in Barrow in Furness. And I think we have to kind of get curious about that, right? You have to kind of say, well, why is that happening? What can we do to kind of redress that? And the report that we're speaking about today touches on that. It talks about the differences in urban and rural economies, and it talks about different attitudes to education within different parts of the population. But I think we have to get more curious. We have to find out why and then work out what to do to address it. And obviously there's not going to be one kind of magic bullet there. Widening participation to higher education has been part of the answer. It's been a really important part of the answer, and will likely to continue to be that. But to kind of make real meaningful action, I think we're probably going to need to see changes, a few kind of policy changes across the board. Some of that is about things that we would like to see anyway for other reasons, maintenance loans, reintroducing maintenance grants, but it has to also be about targeted investment in low participation areas that improves the access to kind of broader tertiary education opportunities and provides pathways into universities and that type of kind of more formal higher education if that's the best thing for the individual. I think I would also be really keen to personally to see some kind of clearer use of contextual admissions in universities that enables those populations to understand the grades that they will need to achieve to kind of get into university, and frankly help them to understand that perhaps university is for them.
Chris, what would your advice be then to Vice Chancellors in how to pick this up and run with it?
Well, so I've got probably three bits to that. I think the first thing, and it's always quite difficult when you're a vice chancellor to be told this, is read it, because there is a lot in there. And there's a lovely little typology of characteristics of less favoured areas. And I haven't got the page number written down, but it talks about remoteness, it talks about transport, it talks about former mining areas, it talks about former manufacturing areas. And I don't think there's a single pathology of disadvantage. So I think getting under the skin of that feels really important. And the second thing is that I do think that thinking about support and progression, and we know that intensive early support to manage the transition to higher education can pay huge dividends, that it happens in all places. So I think really hard about how you're supporting diverse groups once they're recruited. The most strategic thing, and I'm sort of absolutely, more I think about the sector, the more I think about this, if as part of your proposition around excellence and distinctiveness, you have to have some thinking around place and how you interact with place. And that doesn't need to be a single thing, you know, that different universities will interact with their places in different ways. But having thought coherently, strategically about place, which was one of the things that Bob Kerslake's Civic University report said 6 years ago, I think that's fundamental. So read the report, think about support, but most fundamentally, think about how you interact with place and places. I've always said that education is the next best thing to a record deal, and I think that the Social Mobility Commission report by and large bears that out.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on Wocky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wocky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks so much to Chris, Steph and Debbie, Michael Salmon for making it all happen. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.